The following podcast is a presentation of the Washington College of Law at American University. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
Thank you all for coming this afternoon. I'm Sean Flynn, Associate Director of Bishops, and we're co-sponsoring this event. We're very excited, actually, to be here and co-sponsor this event with our environmental faculty and student groups to pull together the intersection of these two issues. Intellectual property, the way we conceive it, is a topic that overlaps with many other fields. Overlaps with human rights and access to essential goods and services. And the overlap that we want to highlight today is with the environmental. And the topic of the World Intellectual Property Organization it also highlights an overlap with international law institutions. So it's an exciting event for us to help highlight some of our partnerships with other organizations both on campus and our longstanding partnership with Scale, where we work on many of these issues previously. So let me just have the student groups. We have Daniel and Tamara come up and just welcome you all, and then we'll have Marcos lead off the introduction of the event today. Thank you for coming.
Hi, my name is Tamara Testovich, and as president of WCO's Intellectual Property Law Society, I'd like to welcome you all to today's event. We are fortunate enough to have a distinguished panel of speakers here speaking with us today. I'd also like to take this opportunity to introduce Jason Baum, our vice president, and Vicky Chow, our secretary. As the IPLS, we strive to provide a number of forums, events, and speakers for the students interested in intellectual property, and we've had people come from all over the state so far to speak with our students. We'd also like to take this opportunity to thank CL and PGIP for allowing us to co-sponsor this event, which we think is really important to the students.
And my name is Daniel Brindis. I'm representing two other co-sponsoring groups, the Sustainable Development and Law Policy Brief, and we have some sample issues over here. Actually, we have some staff members that are translators. Yeah, so, and we once a year we publish translated version in French and Spanish of the best articles of the year, our selected ones. And we do have a climate change reporter, our annual climate change issue coming out this coming winter. And if you're interested in working with SDLP, come and contact us. And if you're a practitioner, we do have a call for papers out, and if you'd like to submit something for publication, please contact me or pick up one of the cards or issues outside. And then for the Environmental Law Society, I see a lot of familiar faces of people who've been to our event this semester, and we will be having an event next semester also. In particular, this coming Thursday, we are going to have an environmental law career panel, and we are going to present three or four speakers who representing the private sector, the NGO world, and the public sector government. And they will offer some advice and tell their stories and benefits and disadvantages of their career path. So it's going to be a great opportunity to meet some practitioners and get some advice. So that's this Thursday, room 100. It's going to be from 12 to 1, and we will be serving empanadas. No further ado, Marcos.
Thank you for those introductions. It is my pleasure and honor to moderate this panel. Probably the easiest task I've had.
Just try to keep me to my time, by the way.
Okay, I struggle. What to do? As we know, intellectual property intersects with a number of areas in the sustainable development context. The convention is one of them, human rights is another. Technology issues are central to sustainability. As we've heard, human rights issues are also implicated in intellectual property discussions. And likewise, access to genetic resources and the equitable share of the benefits derived therefrom have been an important element in the discussions at the international level. These are some of the topics that this panel will address, and we will talk to you Diego Chavalala about the Citizen's Guide to White Code that CL has put out. So, without further ado, I will introduce the speakers. Professor Peter Jassy will go first. He's a faculty director of the Glasgow Amazon Intellectual Property Clinic here at the American University of Washington College of Law.
Absolutely.
And Professor David Hunter, Assistant Professor and Director of the Program on International and Comparative Environmental Law, also here at the law school. Introducing the WIPO guide, Don Diego Chabalala is the Director of the Intellectual Property and Sustainable Development Project at the Center for International Environmental Law. Welcome all.
Thank you. And let me also add my greetings to those that you've already heard from Sean and from the student organization leaders. This is a very special occasion. As Sean pointed out, the topic is an important one. The publication of the guide is an extremely auspicious event for reasons that we'll all have something to say about in a little while. But for me personally, this is an extremely happy occasion because my association with CL really goes back to the beginnings of WCL's connection with that organization. I had the privilege to be involved in the very, very beginnings of the CL-WCL partnership, which led eventually to our wonderful curriculum in international environmental law, over which David Hunter now presides so ably. And CL and WCL have partnered on a series of occasions over time, always with, I think, good results, and always, too, with a very happy experience. I see Professor Christine Farley has joined us, and I will let Christine and just say that we are co-directors of the Bishop in that capacity too. We're extremely, extremely pleased to be involved in this event. I thought I'd start just sort of giving you a little warm up in the form of an old copyright lawyer's perspective on international organizations in the field. I've been a watcher of WIPO and its partners and competitors in the international for 5 years now, and a lot has happened over that time, and now, some of that history, I think, has direct relevance to the current moment, which we will explore later on in the panel. Some of it may simply be interesting background. But in one form or another, WIPO or its predecessor organizations have been around for more than a century. Because ever since the first major multilateral international intellectual property agreements, the Paris Convention and the Berne Convention were concluded toward the end of the 19th century, there was a need for some kind of a secretariat organization to support the treaties and to do all of the scout work that is associated with running a major international agreement. And WIPO and its predecessor organizations have been that really since the inception of the modern multilateral intellectual property law system. But over time, beginning in the middle of the 20th century, the organization has really taken on increasingly another additional role, which is as an actual or would-be leader in the formation of international intellectual property policy. In other words, WIPO has moved gradually over time from what was effectively a kind of passive service provider role into what the organization itself conceptualizes as a leadership role. And you don't have to look any farther than the WIPO website, which is chock full of interesting information, although it is also perhaps the worst organized website to see the sense of leadership, this sense, if you will, of mission that is now an essential part of WIPO's self-identity. So the question is not whether this is an agency on a mission, but what the mission is. And that's something which has changed really quite dramatically a couple of times, at least, since I first became aware of WIPO and became a part-time amateur WIPO watcher a quarter century ago. It's hard to remember this, but back in the 1980s, under the leadership of the then Director General Arpa Bosch, WIPO had for a while a reputation as being a dangerously pro-development organization. There was a period in the 1980s as WIPO was trying to position itself as an organization both within the UN system and otherwise, because of course WIPO is a specialized agency of the United Nations. There was a time in the 1980s when WIPO kind of sought out and cultivated and advocated for the interests of developing countries in opposition, or at least in tension with, the somewhat different interests of the most developed countries, where intellectual property protection at the international and domestic levels was concerned. And in fact, I think, one of the reasons that the United States became much more active in WIPO, a shift that really occurred, was marked, among other things, by the entry into the Berne Union, into the membership of the Berne Convention for the Protection of Literary and Artistic Works of the United States in 1989. One of the reasons that the United States took that step of getting so much more involved in WIPO was because we thought, our government thought, that we had a kind of, there was a need to counteract the unchecked influence of the developing world in this organization. Well, we did a good job. And other pressures also conspired to produce tremendous changes in WIPO's sense of mission. Perhaps the most important of those changes was the rise in the field of international organizations with some interest in or responsibility for intellectual property policy of a new player, the World Trade Organization. Up to that point, WIPO really hadn't had any natural competitors, let alone predators, in the environment of international intellectual property law. There was UNESCO, which sort of messed around a little bit on the margins of copyright law, but it was a trivial and not a serious rival to the big blue building in Geneva. And then in 1994, when we got the Uruguay Act of what was then the World Trade Organization Agreement, with its TRIPS Annex, which for the first time articulated minimum standards for international intellectual property protection in the economic context of international trade, suddenly WIPO was getting an institutional run for its money from its sister organization down by the lake. And this produced a whole set of changes in WIPO's activities and its orientation. There were some of us, I have to say, in the mid-90s, who were forecasting the withering away of WIPO, who thought that given the new jurisdiction of WTO, it was only a matter of time before that new, powerful, well-funded, well-connected organization with its very large international membership would literally put its older competitor in the shade. But it didn't happen. WIPO proved to be nimbler and more adept at sort of close infighting in the international institutional context than anyone, or at least anyone I know, predicted. What happened instead was a dramatic shift in the organization's policy orientation, a shift toward becoming the, what's a polite way to say this, the mouthpiece, now that's not particularly polite, but maybe it's most accurate anyway, the mouthpiece for both the substantive policies and the accompanying rhetoric of the advocates, both nation states and corporations, of the highest possible levels of intellectual property protection for every imaginable subject matter. By the mid-1990s, WIPO had become an organization which had staked, or appeared to have staked, its institutional reputation on outdoing WTO in its orientation toward a high protectionist regime. And you still see, or if you can find them, on the WIPO website, plenty of traces of that ideological shift that occurred in the mid-1990s. It was a really dramatic and, as I've already suggested, at least temporarily successful effort at institutional redefinition. And that, plus a number of other sort of strategic initiatives, WIPO's entry into the field, for instance, of dispute resolution, where internet domain names are concerned, being one small but salient example. Number of initiatives basically revived this organization and brought it back, you know, to use another environmental or ecological metaphor, from the verge of extinction. It also left it poised in a very uncomfortable place vis-a-vis all the countries of the world and all the interests of civil society who have some concerns about the benefits of a high protectionist rationale or the high protectionist position on IP policy. Then in the mid-60s, once this shift in orientation had been substantially accomplished, another really fascinating thing took place. And this, although others might disagree, this is a sort of a copyright lawyer's view of the development, and there probably are other stories that can be told, maybe will be told. But in the mid-1990s, one of the projects that WIPO conceived was the project of, say, updating the Berne Convention. It wasn't quite a normal update, because they weren't actually proposing a new act of the convention. What they were doing instead was to, what they did instead was to set in motion a process to create what was first going to be a protocol to the Berne Convention and then turned into two new treaties, the WIPO Copyright Treaty and the WIPO Performers and Phonograms Treaty, both of which were concluded in 1996. These were very controversial proposals, and given WIPO's character at that moment, the versions of the drafts of these proposed new treaties that came out of the WIPO staff work were inherently very controversial because, they took the high protectionist line on every possible issue. So much so that, for almost the first time, the larger civil society actually became engaged with the WIPO process. In the years 1995 and 1996, well, late 1994 to 1996, saw an effort, an unprecedented effort, by non-governmental organizations to kind of elbow their way into what had been the essentially closed decision-making process of WIPO in order to make themselves heard on the question of all of the obnoxious features that had been included by staff in these draft treaties. and the non-governmental organizations, civil society organizations, some of them from developing countries, and many of them also from the developed countries, found that they could, in many instances, make effective alliances with the formal representatives in WIPO of less and least developed countries. And this was a new kind of politics. This was something the WIPO had really never seen before, this kind of civil society politics and this notion of coalition making between NGOs and country representatives. And I think those events, whatever we think of the final treaties, about all we can really say about them is that they aren't as bad as they could have been. Whatever we think of the final treaties in 1996, the real significance of those events, looking back, may well have been that the discussion, the politicking around those treaties had the effect of beginning to pry open what had previously been a closed and even to some extent hermetic system in Geneva. Since then, there has been a dramatic set of developments that we'll be hearing more about today, and that is pressure from outside WIPO, from the developing countries, and from their NGO allies in the larger civil society to bring about a substantial change in the organization's central positions on the most important intellectual property questions of the day. And that is, of course, I'm referring to advocacy for the so-called WIPO development agenda. It is too late, it is too early to say how successful this advocacy is going to be. It is too early to say whether this attempt to shift, this attempt by the developing countries and civil society organizations to fundamentally shift the priorities of WIPO back to a more balanced position will succeed and fail. But it is unprecedented in the century in change during which this organization and its predecessors have existed. So we are here at an exciting time, and the guide, which is in part a toolkit for change-making of the kind that I've just described, is going to prove to be an indispensable document. I'm going to shut up in a minute, but I want to say one other thing about WIPO. And I say this as a friend of WIPO, in some respects, but I must tell the truth. WIPO has never been a model of transparency in its practices and procedures. WIPO has, for the 25 years that I've known it at least, always been an organization that has held close the critical information about its decision-making processes and its internal activities. And there have been sometimes attempts to sort of shine light on the inner workings of WIPO, and those attempts have, for the most part, not been terribly effective. So I don't want to promote the guide as a work of investigative journalism, because it's clearly not intended to be that. It's an objective and balanced tool for policy advocacy. But it has to be said that we now, thanks to this publication, know more in a more systematic way about the internal functions and this functioning of this organization than we have ever known before. So one of the things I'm going to do with the guide is assign it as essential reading when I teach international copyright next semester, because there's never been anything like it. So this is a really exciting occasion. We're delighted to have you guys with us, and I'm going to stop now and turn to you.
Thank you. Well, I'm going to give a different perspective on it, coming from someone who I can first say never thought when I was in law school 21 years ago that I would ever be on a panel that would include a discussion of intellectual property rights. Not because I had anything against intellectual property rights, but because I knew little then about them, and as somebody who was always going to do environmental work, didn't see the relevance. And I can also say that I'm going to come to this panel as someone who is exactly the client for the guide, because I continue to know just enough now about WIPO and intellectual property rights to be dangerous. And also enough to know that this guide wasn't as needed in the issues. My education about the relationship between intellectual property rights and environmental law, I'm going to put in environmental issues into a kind of a historical perspective as well, though not going back to the 100 years that Peter did. I'm going to go back to the major themes around the Earth Summit in 1992 to reflect on why it is that today we're here discussing about the relationship between intellectual property rights and the environment. And there are three basic themes there that were happening in 1992 at the Earth Summit in Rio that relate to this that I want to just mention quickly. One is the theme of sort of the adoption of sustainable development. I'll come back to these in a minute. The second is the idea that this was going to be a global environmental movement of the environmental movement and development movement, first to reach sustainable development, and second, to really go global. So we had from the north to embrace the developing country agendas in the south. And the third aspect of Rio that I want to use as kind of principles to look at this is that Rio was really, the Earth Summit was really an expression of the emergence of the global civil society, at least in the environmental context, that Peter has just mentioned. And with it brought a certain culture to international dialogue that hadn't really perhaps existed as much previously, a culture around transparency and participation. So if I go back to those three issues, the first one being sustainable development and its acceptance at Rio, and we can see this in many different ways, but we'll talk for a moment just about sustainable development as a principle of integration and the need to integrate economics and the environment. Now, mind you, I graduated the year before Our Common Future was published, in which sustainable development was first publicized, and the idea of integrating economics and environment, though we thought about it, we didn't really have a name for it, we didn't really understand it. But by the time Rio comes along, we did understand that this integration of environment and development was going to be very important. And it played itself out in several different ways. One of the most important ways for intellectual property rights that it played itself out was how the Convention on Biological Diversity ended up being negotiated at the Earth Summit. So we environmentalists were approaching this great, and you guys are cheating on the know this, many of you know this, we were approaching this great event as an environmental event with the idea that we were going to talk about saving bees and bunnies and nature. And when we got there, we realized that the dialogue had to expand, and with respect to biodiversity conservation, it would have to expand to a set of, to looking at biodiversity in terms of its resources, particularly its genetic resources, its biological diversity resources, and how are we going to look at that? Well, the South was first very clear that, that genetic resources were part of their sovereignty. And the overall theme at the time was that we could, that in this idea of genetic resources and the idea that, for example, drug companies and others would be able to find information in plant varieties or in traditional knowledge of indigenous peoples, that in these, this search for information would rise a economic benefit that would promote biodiversity conservation and would be the sort of development side of biodiversity conservation. So the Convention on Biological Diversity became less a nature conservation agreement and more a sustainable development agreement by embracing the issues of how there would be access to genetic resources and how those resources and the benefits from those resources would be shared by first developing countries and then the local communities within developing countries, particularly indigenous and traditional communities that might have had particular knowledge. So as the convention started to negotiate those issues, and the environmentalists who were promoting it, again, coming from very little knowledge about intellectual property rights, you can't talk about those issues, it turns out, without suddenly stepping on the toes of intellectual property rights. It turns out, we didn't know at the time when we were starting this discussion, but if you want to talk about the benefits that will come from the development of genetic resources into either different drugs or different products, then the rest of the world have been talking about that in terms of providing intellectual property rights, patents for plant varieties, things like that. So the Convention on Biological Diversity and Environmental Convention looking to move over into integrate into economic issues and sustainable development then had to address in at least an oblique way intellectual property rights. And it did this in Article 16 explicitly by saying, look, we know that intellectual property rights and patents are going to be important for the systems that will be set up to provide access to our genetic resources from the South and for ensuring that benefits are given to local communities. And so, parties, you governments, please make sure that the national and international laws are consistent with the objectives of this convention. Well, that doesn't really help us when we move forward and realize that we're then, it doesn't help us solve the problem, but it does help frame the problem in a different way. And the Environmental Convention, Biodiversity Convention, best in some ways laid down, if not a gauntlet, at least a marker, that it viewed its scope as including issues around intellectual property rights. Now, the problem for the CBD, the Convention on Biological Diversity, is that it was not clear that it would be the primary international institution that would be able to sort out how we get the two regimes, the intellectual property rights regime and the biodiversity regime, to have consistent objectives. And in fact, for those of us who were fresh from the trade and environment debates, more generally, we fully recognize that probably the economic institutions, in this case WIPO, would be the location for this debate, more so than the Secretariat on Biological Diversity, although part of our struggle would be to try to keep the Environmental Secretariat engaged and involved and a seat at the table. But this presented a tremendous problem for us because we didn't even know what WIPO was at that point in time and didn't know anything about intellectual property rights. So it was a tremendous education of environmental lawyers that had to take place in the early 1990s to understand how this would relate and how to try to doctrinally integrate the doctrine of intellectual property rights with this new set of concerns about benefit sharing around genetic resources and as well as around traditional knowledge. And that continues to be a major overlap of these areas of environment and intellectual property rights today. The second sort of principle that ran through Rio, though, that also gives us a highlight of the relationship between intellectual property rights and the environment, was this idea that we needed to embrace environmental and sustainable development issues as a global issue, which meant that we had to bring developing countries into what would become known as a global partnership for sustainable development. Now, the partnership was basically this, that developing countries would agree to participate in global environmental issues like biodiversity conservation and climate change and addressing the ozone layer and many of the same global issues we hear today. And in response, the northern countries would provide financial resources and access to environmentally sound technologies. This was the grand bargain of Rio that continues to animate global negotiations today. And it can be found in principles such as the principle of common but differentiated responsibilities, whereby every country agrees that it has some obligations to address global environmental issues, but they're different depending on where you sit within the global economic sphere in particular. The obligation of industrialized countries in this partnership was to provide access on preferred, perhaps, bases and fair bases to developing countries, particularly for environmental sound technologies. So another whole area where intellectual property rights and issues around WIPO become very important in the overarching global environmental issues are in on what terms and how will we promote and transfer technologies that we may need to address global environmental issues? Particularly, this is particularly poignant today with respect to climate change and with discussions about how we're going to have to very rapidly both create new technologies and then disseminate them. And to what extent will intellectual property rights be shaped in a way that helps that or hurts that? And that continues to be as well a big part of the debate. And the third line that runs through this period in the early 1990s that shapes our debate still today and our relationship to WIPO is the one that Professor Yazzie mentioned, which is the idea of civil society and participation. For the environmental movement, the Earth Summit in 1992 was really the sort of landmark moment when the movement went global and started interacting as a global civil society. And it also came with it, brought with it a certain culture that was a culture that expected, as it had found was the case at least in U.S. environmental law, but in a lot of other laws as well, but particularly driven by a view in the U.S. of environmental activists, that the first and most important aspects of environmental law were that citizens had a right in our country to sue, but a right to participate and a right to access to information. And during this period of the early 90s, when the environmental lobby started to go a little bit global, they ran into a lot of very dark boxes sitting in places like Geneva or, in the case of the World Bank, in Washington, D.C. And these boxes, shockingly to us, when you knocked on the door and said, you know, we're the public, we're civil society, we're here to dialogue, the answer was that the door is locked on the other side, and that, you know, and you heard the chains rattling, they weren't opening, you know. And this was a very odd response to those in civil society who were used to having access to environmental information. And it spawned both Principle 10 in the Rio Declaration that addresses public participation and access to information and things like that. And it also spawned the civil society dialogue that would take place with international organizations in the mid-1990s. Now, for intellectual property rights, I think it's fair to say that in the early 90s and the mid-90s, until very recently, it was almost indistinguishable to civil society environmentalists the difference between the WTO and WIPO. We wanted to deal with trade-related aspects of intellectual property rights. We wanted to deal, it seemed like trade, and there wasn't really that much of a subtle understanding among most. It got wrapped up pretty much in the same environmental dialogue around trade and the environment generally and around the relationship with the WTO. But the principles were very much the same. Greater access to information, a seat at the table, and ultimately a recognition, somewhat slower in some ways with respect to the WTO, that there was an alignment of interests around this development agenda with developing country representatives. And we really would see that a little bit first in the Seattle talks, certainly in the Cancun talks, where there would be, around the WTO, explicit strategy of reaching out among civil society environmental groups and developing country representatives to bring a shared vision to these international organizations. This is really a challenge to the long-standing way, as Professor Yazzie has mentioned, of viewing intellectual property or trade issues as really a closed issue among a very discrete set of economic interests. This was a suggestion that there were multi-stakeholder needs for multi-stakeholder involvement in a much more open process. But of course, to participate in that part of the culture, to bring our side of the bargain as civil society, we got to know what we're talking about. And the education of us about this whole new sets of areas has been a slow but very important process. And it's a process that I'm happy to say, since I was once at Seattle, has been a process that Seattle has been at the forefront of doing, both pushing for transparency and educating people about how to interact with what can be very technical and very distant norms than what we're used to in the environmental area. And it's particularly happy for me to see that the Citizens Guide continue to exist at CL, because I think the first one was on the World Bank inspection panel some 15 years ago. And I think they embody, as my final comment, kind of an aspect of what lawyers do that we shouldn't lose sight of, which is that lawyers explain things that are difficult to their clients, and in this case to the public, which is CL's client, and things that are hard to understand, like the relationship of intellectual property rights to development and the environment and how to use something as distant-sounding as the World Intellectual Property Organization. Because once you can understand how to use it, it doesn't seem quite so daunting. So I am very happy to be here, and I'm happy to see that you guys continue the good work of explaining difficult issues need to be able to engage in these international
issues. Gabriel is coming from Geneva, I understand. So he brings insights as to why for assemblies, and of course he's been the lead author.
Found a misplaced my presentation from the so we found it. In the process, actually, of listening to both David and Peter, I've somewhat restructured my presentation, so. Bear with me while I integrate. But as David has pointed out, CL has been a part of the issues at WIPO since the very early beginnings of civil society involvement in the World Intellectual Property Organization. We were neophytes, along with many other groups, and have been fortunate enough to be able to stay and continue sustained engagement with the organization until we become relative experts on the organization. I say relative because I'm going to outline for you in a little bit just how complex this can get. Now, I'm going to cover a little bit of the role of civil society at WIPO and then give a sense of why the guide is needed and maybe a sense of how it can be used and why this may be one of the best available moments for doing so. Historically, WIPO has been dominated by rights holder organizations and business groups. It made sense in the original organization, which saw these groups as their natural constituency. These were the people, the rights holder groups, who the organization served. These were in the days before it became a UN specialized agency, but has continued since then. And they've been the dominant players and still continue to be the dominant players in the organization. Civil society, defined in the traditional way of public interest organizations that represent the citizens, whereas WIPO, because of its historical behavior, civil society also includes business associations and rights holder organizations. And so they have an interestingly skewed view of who the public interest is, who the public is in that sense. And it's something that's also informed this behavior over time. I will say, however, that it meant that when civil society traditionally thought did show up at WIPO, we had very much the same rights that the traditional rights holder organizations had always had. They found it difficult to differentiate and prevent civil society groups from having the same access, at least in a formal level, to the organization that rights holder organizations had had. And so there had been a chance historically to ramp up involvement in the organization in ways that I think have been very difficult to do in other places. The clear example of this is that the involvement of civil society comes from three different veins. One of the first veins that's been pointed out is that the one that came out of concerns about the WIPO copyright treaty and the WIPO performances of the phonograph treaty out of a copyright and open source and freedom and access to knowledge movement, largely out of the US and Europe, angered by the sense that what had happened at WIPO was an end run around domestic US policymaking, that rights holders had gone outside the country to establish international standards, which then brought back and essentially forced onto the domestic policymaking scene. And so this forced domestic players to realize that they had to be engaged at the international level if they wanted to maintain some control over the domestic or some participation in domestic policymaking processes. The other part of it comes from the health groups, and this comes out of work that many civil society organizations did within the WTO processes, challenging the public health elements of the TRIPS agreement. There was a very clear fight, a very clear issue, around which a large group of civil society groups coalesced with groups of developing countries. And Geneva was a crucial part of developing those alliances, and those alliances were translated into work then in WIPO, as WIPO began to work on becoming a WTO plus organization. And so those alliances between developing countries and civil society then were plugged into processes at WIPO. It helped that in most developing countries as well, the delegates who works on IP issues in one organization works on them in another organization, or works on that and human rights and other things, so that you have the weakness that developing countries had was also a strength in the sense that you could transfer knowledge and skills between organizations. The weakness is that they're spread very thin. The third sort of input comes out of, as David pointed out, the environmental movement, and specifically involvement in the Intergovernmental Committee on Genetic Resources, Intellectual Property, Traditional Knowledge, and Folklore, which from now on are called the IGC. But that brought a whole different group of actors in, indigenous and local communities, as well as the secretariat, which identified, and this is one of the more curious things about this, which is the secretary identified this as a new group of rights holders who it could serve. It happened that it also happened to serve ideas of equity and justice and development for these groups and for these developing countries. But the explosion and the interest and the establishment of the committee was very much a coalition of developing countries, elements of the secretariat, and civil society that came in. So we have, in the late 1990s, and early 2000s, a coalescence of these three strands into WIPO. Out of this comes, I think, not to find a point with it, the push for the development agenda. And this was a process that was gestated essentially outside the normal processes at WIPO. It wasn't gestated in a committee. It wasn't proposed by one country and then gathered. It was done in meetings between civil society representatives, interested groups of developing countries in a building outside the WIPO building, and run in separate meetings until there had been coalescence around particular sets of proposals. And then a group of countries came and proposed it in the organization. And it was a very powerful process that really, I think, captured what a moment of understanding about the integration of economic development, innovation, equity, justice, and sustainable development. So there have been, I think, examples of the success and strength of civil society in the organization. The IGC process has been, the establishment of the IGC was one major success. We have to say that the process in the IGC has not necessarily been successful. We have been waiting now for a very long period of time to see real progress in that area. The development agenda, which was finally adopted at the most recent General Assembly's in the change between September and October, I think can be attributed in some part to the push and the working of civil society in the organization. The fact that the WIPO Broadcast Treaty, which was the third pillar of the WIPO Copyright Treaty and the WPPT, and was meant to be the third pillar for the broadcasters, has essentially come to a grind and a halt. because of the actions of civil society. But this isn't to say that white folk ain't an easy place to work. And in fact, much of this has happened not necessarily because of how strong civil society organizations are, but sometimes in spite of, as a function of, the politics between different groups of developing countries and the politics of the secretariat, which has become increasingly weakened as the leadership of the organization has become increasingly weakened and under siege. Many of you may have been hearing rumors and stories and articles about the slow and painful downfall of the Director General at WIPO. That has come to the fore, but the process has been ongoing for quite some time, as the Director General has moved from being the darling of the major developed countries, losing their support, and in the process trying to keep himself alive by meeting at some level the needs and the desires of some developing countries. So it's a confluence of events that involve the politics of survival at the top of the organization. And there are other problems. We can divide them a little arbitrarily, but I think usefully, into structural issues and process issues. At the structural level, we have the problem of the complexity of the government structure at WIPO. To throw some labels at you, WIPO consists of several unions who have a formal relationship with the organization, but are not WIPO bodies per se. They are the unions of treaties that were passed that then have asked WIPO to serve as a portion of the secretariat thereof. There are several organs, the WIPO Coordination Committee, the General Assembly, another organization which is meant to coordinate between those three organizations. There are subcommittees, some of which are committees that report directly to General Assembly, subcommittees there are subcommittees that report just to other committees, Program and Budget Committee, and in all of these organs, we have substantive issues being addressed. So we run into the way some matter is structured at WIPO. It's boring and opaque. You run into the problem of the division of such matter into little bits that are addressed in different committees. And so following a particular issue becomes extremely difficult. And then overbalanced by right holder organizations as well. And in the process, information is scarce and opaque. It's difficult to identify the targets of action. Where's your hook? Who do you talk to? The rules of observership and participation are difficult, protracted. The nature of the discussion, despite the fact that the subject matter to be addressed, is largely political. And so the language used is obtuse, not necessarily addressing the actual subject matter at hand or technical nature of the subject matter at hand, but it's really all about the political process, figuring out when do you talk, what do we talk about now, what should the agenda be, all fights about substance but hidden behind issues of agenda and process. And finally, what we have seen happen over the past 10 years of moving from more formal deliberations in open forum to closed deliberations in informal meetings where the decisions get made. And of course, I think for many people, yes, you realize that this is the case in all organizations, but at WIPO, it's been a deliberate move to get away from civil society in this sense. So, why the guide? We are finally, I think, in a position to hold the organization accountable for its mandate. They said, finally, that there is a development agenda. There is a mandate. There are a set of standards with development and can be held. Development can be measured. We can see it. And it finally enables us to find a hook. So in that sense, now that there is this hook, it will be easier for civil society to become more involved in ways that provide easier targets to act. How does the guide do this? We provide, essentially, information about which organs, how they work, what they do, what their processes are, and who to talk to, as well as, of course, how you get into the building in the first place. And we do so through, we hope, concrete examples that show both successes and some of the failures. It's important to learn from the ways in which we've lost certain fights at the organization. But I would like to really emphasize that it's meant as a tool, as a way, as a means. And I am looking forward to it being used as an educational tool. But if we don't see people coming, more people coming in the door, it won't have done its job. So we hope that people read this, that you all read this, that you pass it on to everybody you know and all your friends. And finally, hopefully that it explains exactly how and why these issues are important and how you can get in there and speak to these people. We will work on the other end as well to ensure that there's more transparency, that there's more webcasting of these issues, and that there's better access to information. With that, I'd like to present to all of you the WIPO guide, which is available on the WIPO website at it's available on the CIEL website, www.ciel.org. And we'll be emailed to all and sundry. And thank you.
Thank you, James, for that presentation. I think that the 30 minutes of teaching at least has probably a couple of questions if they're burning, and if not, we can continue this discussion after in the talk. Any burning? Okay, so in that case, I would like to thank the panelists for the insightful organizations for helping to put this together, ILSP, the National Media Studies Program, and the Program on Information, Justice, and Intellectual Property. Professor Shelflin, framing the constitution of the project from CL. And I encourage, as Taylor said, encourage all of you to use this guide and become more involved in these intersections that lead towards sustainable development.